You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. I'm your host, Brent Thomas, and I'm thrilled to have you here with us tonight. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for being a part of what we're doing here on the Paranormal Portal. And you guys make us awesome. That's all I got to say. But before I go any further, please let me welcome my good friend and co-host, Mr. Don Longbeard.
That would be this guy.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to announce a wonderful man, somebody I look up to a great deal. He's a fellow co-host on TFR as well on X Squared Radio. He is a scientist, an engineer, a chemist, an entrepreneur. He is a best-selling author on Amazon, has a new book out, The Charm of Favor, it's a story of the Clinton Crime Syndicate, available on Amazon. And he's just all of these things, and he's also somebody that has a strong belief in the paranormal and has this amazing spiritual grounding to him and a spiritual awareness, which to me is like the full deal. He's the whole package. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Brooks Agnew to the show. Brooks, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you so much, Brent. Good to be here. It's about time we had an interview at a decent hour.
Absolutely. And by that, do you mean really late at night?
Well, yeah, I mean, because we're late night people.
That's true.
You know, none of my friends are up at midnight, you know, so this it's midnight where I'm at in Central Time. So it's just good to have friends that like to talk about this kind of stuff at this time of night. I love it.
It sets the tone for sure. I mean, the late night hours and the paranormal just seem to go hand in hand.
Absolutely. And by the way, I think it's an oxymoron to stay spiritually grounded. I think they're kind of two different things.
You're probably
that's okay,
right.
That's okay. I don't mind. Grounded in the cloud.
Well, you know, last time you were on the show, of course, we had just an amazing discussion. And I can pretty unequivocally say for Don and myself that you absolutely blew our socks off.
Yeah.
We knew you were an intelligent guy, but the things you brought to the table, I mean, clearly you had us sitting here basically drooling wide eyed and mouth open.
No pressure.
Well, you know, the cool part about it was, though, and ladies and gentlemen, if you get a chance, please stop to youtube.com/paranormalportal, and you can check out Brooks's first visit on the portal. And it was amazing. It was, I don't know, a few months ago now. But the nice thing about it was you brought in all these profoundly elaborate and complex scientific principle, but you broke it down in such a way that it wasn't overwhelming. It was digestible even by someone like me, which is which is no easy feat, let me tell you. So you have a bard's tongue as far as
well. Let's see if we can do that again.
Absolutely.
Where would you like to go?
Well, you know, I know one of the things that I'd really like to take more time and discuss tonight, if we could, and it's something that we only got an opportunity to brush the tip of last time you were on, and that was the whole Hollow Earth idea. I know there's a lot of people out there that believe in this, and then, you know, there's a lot of people that don't. And you were bringing some pretty amazing things to the table, but then just ran out of time.
It happens, doesn't it? So let's see. You know, there's we often use the term Hollow Earth theory, but it really isn't a theory. It's more of a Hollow Earth hypothesis. Because normally what we do in science, we find things that we don't understand, and we make a hypothesis about what our expectation is about that understanding. And then we either try to prove or disprove that hypothesis. A null hypothesis is you try to say, okay, the Earth is a molten ball floating through space, and we live on the crust of it just by sheer luck. Mm-hmm. And so then what you try to do is come up with enough evidence to prove that is so. And if you can, then Hollow Earth theory, or Hollow Earth, the idea of a Hollow Earth, doesn't hold merit. And I guess we've been trying to do that for a long, long time. And we have, fortunately, a lot of instrumentation applied to trying to gather enough facts to validate that experiment. We have seismology, we have oceanography, we have space-based science, we have, even the more esoteric, I'll call them, for lack of a better word, sciences. And with all of that, we still can't prove that the Earth is a molten ball floating through space. Because the data doesn't support it. I mean, we can manipulate it, which they do. If you open up any geology textbook, you'll see their theory of, you know, why the Earth is what I just described, based on seismographic information. Mm-hmm. And what they do to make the data fit is they realize that they're getting vibrations. Let's say there's an earthquake, a big earthquake, in the South Pacific, mm-hmm. and on the Pacific Rim. Well, it thumps the Earth, and the vibrations go through the planet, and they're picked up by seismographs or seismology instruments all over the planet. So it's kind of like, a bat will send out sound waves in a cave, mm-hmm. and it'll bounce off things in the air like mosquitoes, and it can locate it based on that sonic reflection.
Sure.
And go pick a mosquito out of mid-flight. Well, we do the same thing with the Earth. These vibrations go through the planet. They bounce off all the structures in the planet, and they arrive at various times based on how fast sound goes through solid or molten matter, according to their calculations. But the issue is that they get a whole set of waves that should not be there if that was the way Earth was made. So they classify in three ways. One is called a pressure wave, a P wave. The other is called a shear wave, an S wave. But the other set are called shadow waves, or a shadow zone. These are waves that arrive at seismograms that shouldn't be there. They don't really know why they arrive there. So they kind of call them the shadow zones. And that's the picture that you see. And I've got the graphic in the book, Remembering the Future, and I've got it on the website and the presentation that I make about Hollow Earth hypotheses, and that's what's in the textbook. Wow. But if you run the data backwards, that is to say, start at the seismograms and work your way backwards to the earthquake, mm-hmm. you get a totally different picture of the planet. The picture that you get of the planet when you go backwards is about an 800 or 900 mile thick crust, and then the point of contact on the other side. There's no wave that goes through the planet any deeper than about 900 miles. So what you get is this very clear picture of a void inside the planet.
Wow.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's more information that has since been analyzed and validated and repeated that's available in those waves.
Oh my God. So it's essentially could very well be a big chasm in there is what you're saying. It's not, there's no real core. There's no, you know, spinning ball of nickel or whatever in a molten bed. And it's just hollow. Like when we say hollow earth, it's not like there's a crust, there's a, you know, a void layer, and then there's a core underneath that. Is that correct? Or
well, actually, there is data to prove that very thing.
Really?
What the Japanese have been doing and what Cambridge University has been doing and what Stanford University is doing, they all have divisions of what are called planetary core tectonics. And what they have been researching are frequencies that they have been getting from the center of the Earth, from the core. And these frequencies are spectrographically analyzed. And it sounds like a complicated word, but let me try to break it down. If you were to have a blindfold on and somebody in the room played an open string on a guitar, you could tell which one was the E string, which one is the A string. You could tell based right. on your knowledge of the way a guitar sounds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turns out, every single bond between carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen, every single bond has a specific length based on how big the nucleus is. Mm-hmm. And how big the nucleus is, of course, has to do with its position in the periodic chart. So if you go down the periodic chart to the nucleus iron, you will see that it has so many protons, so many neutrons, and that means it has so much of a strong force, all those nuclei, all those proton and neutron particles packed together, which means the bond between iron molecule, iron atoms with one another is a specific link. It's a specific guitar string. So that iron puts out a certain frequency, especially when it's in a large population, like a very dense, solid iron crystal weighing, you know, billions of tons.
Wow.
Sitting there in the center of the Earth. It puts out a single, like a spike on the oscilloscope. And we've been able to validate that in several locations around the planet. So what they've been trying to do, because the shift of this frequency is very slight in terms of nanometers, between, say, a loop of iron and an iron crystal. Hmm. An iron crystal has a certain dense lattice, and it can only exist at a certain temperature. If it's too cool, it can't exist. If it's too hot, it can't exist. It's got to be a certain temperature.
Wow. Okay.
And that temperature is 6,000 degrees Celsius.
Oh, jeez.
So what the Japanese measured the first time that they did this, they speculated based on the vibrations that they're getting in this frequency that the temperature was 5,000 degrees Celsius. Obviously, that threw a big wrench in the works, and everybody thought, well, it's got to be something other than iron because it can't exist as a crystal at that temperature. But then Cambridge University redid, two women actually, redid the experiment with what's called an anvil press. So what they did is they recreated the pressures on the iron crystal in the lab. Hmm. And then they heated it with a laser to 6,000 degrees C. And the peaks lined up perfectly. So that means that the core is sitting there at 6,000 degrees C, which tells us it is a solid iron crystal at the center of the planet. If that's the case, and I just happened to watch today another NASA piece, which is actually pretty recent, that's done on exoplanets, different super Earths that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
and they're examining the atmosphere of the Earth and the surface of the Earth and, you know, different winds on these planets. Some of them are like, you know, 5 or 6 kilometers a second, which is pretty high and full of iron dust and shards of silica. So you could never survive on there. But the point is that they made a statement in this about how planets form in the first place. And the very best, freshest, most current astrophysics we have is that planets form out of these exploded stars. So a star explodes, it forms a tremendous amount of high order molecules like titanium and silica and oxygen and all these elements that are formed by supernovas. Mm-hmm. But then this dust that's left forms a giant accretion disk, like a giant disk of gases and metals and rocks. And over time, what happens is these begin to attract one another, slowly at first, and then faster and faster and faster. So what happens is a star reforms in the middle, or at least enough density for a star. Sometimes they're only the size of Jupiter, and sometimes they're a little larger than that. But then in the rings that are around this, the rings themselves begin to coagulate along a Fibonacci pattern into planets. And as, of course, they collapse, they spin faster and faster and faster. This is a rule we call conservation of momentum. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like an ice skater. You know, she spins, but she really gets going fast when she pulls her arms in.
Right.
So the smaller the diameter she can make, the faster she's going to spin, because she started out with all this energy in her arms, and then she drew it into her core, and she's spinning incredibly fast, so fast sometimes the camera, you know, can't even see it all. Same thing with planets. And then the planet does one of three things. It either spins so fast that it explodes and comes apart again, or it becomes lopsided. Heavy particles gravitate to one side. It becomes lopsided and it spins a piece of itself off like a water droplet, and it forms a moon. Oh. And that moon can, if it's far enough away from the planet, it will revolve on its own axis. If it's really close to the planet, like our Earth is to us, it becomes what we call tidally locked, which means it's the same side faces the planet all the time. Oh. If it gets too close, the planet of the larger body, if it encroaches what's called the Roche limit, will actually overcome the gravity of the smaller planet, and it'll come apart. It'll just come apart altogether, and it will then fall into the planet and become part of the planet again.
Wow.
The point is that this is how our best planetary physics believes that planets form. And if this is the case, there's a third condition I mentioned. Planets will expand and cool and expand and cool and expand and cool. And of course, as they do it, like the ice skater letting her arms back out, the crust slows down. Uh-huh. And as the crust slows down, the core keeps spinning at its original rate. And the two become separated. One spinning just inside of the other on exactly the same north and south magnetic lines. This is what creates a magnetosphere. This counter rotation, a fast spinning core, a slow spinning crust, both of them full of charged metal, forms this giant magnetic field around the planet. And now you have conditions that are suitable for an atmosphere and life.
Wow. So in this gap, then, this gap inside, is that at some fantastic temperature as well? Or would it be presumed that that would be habitable or potentially habitable?
Well, the answer is we don't know.
Okay.
I mean, because we've only drilled in about 9 miles into our crust.
Okay.
So we don't really, I mean, the crust is 900 miles thick. We've only drilled in 9 miles.
Oh.
And as deep as we've gotten, we know that there are areas that are very, very hot. I mean, just look at Hawaii right now. Look at Guatemala. Sure. You'll know what I'm talking about.
Right.
But this is the crust. This is not the core coming through the crust. This is the crust, the mantle of the crust, because the mantle is like a big vibrating 900-mile thick soap bubble. It is not stable. It's moving all the time. It's undulating.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own center of gravity in the center of the crust. So there are really two gravitational lines in our planet. One is the tremendous amount of mass that's gathered in the crust of the Earth, and the other is the core, which is 1,000 miles away from the crust.
Wow.
So if you have a gap there, and it's 1,000 miles thick, and it's full of gas, let's assume it's some kind of atmosphere, then the core would be insulated from the crust. I would imagine it would still be quite hot, but mortals, humans, can take temperatures, as long as they're dry, up to about 250 degrees.
Really?
But we can't take much over that. If it's moist air, we can only take up to about 115, 120 degrees, and then we start to wilt. Because the way our cooling system works, we have an evaporation model, at least I do. And what happens is we push water through the pores of our skin, which evaporates.
Mm-hmm.
And in that evaporation, it cools the skin. So then the skin becomes flush with, you know, small capillaries filled with warm blood. That blood is cooled and then run back into the body. And that's how we maintain our temperature. But that doesn't work so well in a steam room.
Right.
It works okay in a sauna.
Okay.
A sauna is between 225 and 255 degrees, and the human can take that for upwards of an hour, you know, pretty well.
Wow.
Now, I've been reading that they've been looking to drill into the mantle lately.
Yeah, well, you have to get pretty close to the mantle, or the mantle would have to be pretty close to the surface.
Right. They're talking about finding, you know, like Mariana's Trench kind of thing, and getting as deep water as they can to reduce that. What is your ideas on that?
Well, the issues are deep water drilling is hazardous.
Mm-hmm.
We do it in the Gulf. The Gulf is about 5,500 feet deep. We do it in the Arctic, where the ocean is upwards of 4,000 meters deep, but the trench is 23,000 feet deep. It's way down there.
Wow.
The problem is that when you get down that low, you run into other liquids that are more dense than water, like, let's say, liquid methane, that sit down on the bottom of these very deep areas.
That's
in liquid.
Kind of dangerous.
Because it's under so much pressure.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese do tap into that methane. They have pipes that go down there, tap into the methane. They pump it to the surface, and they harvest it. They use it for energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why oceanic warming can be so hazardous, because if it gets to the point where the methane begins to boil, then it will become gaseous, come to the surface, and mix with our atmosphere, and then we do have a real problem.
Yeah,
talk about global warming. You know, we have mass heart attacks everywhere. Even in low concentrations, methane, you know, can stop your heart.
Oof.
So we try not to do that. I mean, just raw methane is okay. I mean, we find that in the oil fields all the time.
Mm.
But when it's mixed with other things like sulfur or alcohol, methanol can be very hazardous. It's totally miscible in blood, and it will stop your heart. And certain concentrations, it will give you a heart attack.
So I guess drilling into the mantle wouldn't be very feasible without some serious safety oversights. I mean, like planetary safety oversights.
Right.
That's crazy.
You have to do it. I would imagine you would not be able to do that from the surface.
Okay, yeah.
You'd have to do it from the bottom.
Okay.
And,
so
and believe it or not, there's a lot of heavy equipment companies that have manufactured equipment right now and it is being used for seabed cultivation. Wow. They look just like surface equipment, except it drives around on the bottom of the sea, huh, and it harvests metals that are plentiful on the sea bottom.
Wow.
Iron and titanium and all kinds of stuff like that. And it's turning into a very, very big industry.
Wow.
Okay, well, we're going to head to our first break already. It's going so quickly, but ladies and gentlemen, don't go away, and we'll continue this discussion. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Paranormal Portal. I'm your host, Brent Thomas. Guest tonight is Mr. Brooks Agnew, and he's already hitting the ground running with this amazing knowledge and understanding of the physical world around us. And we're tying this all into the Hollow Earth ideas and theories and such. But as you're talking, Brooks, I keep thinking, I want to get as much out of you as I can about so many different things, because it's not often you have the option to talk with a person with such a profound understanding about these kind of topics. And I realize we're on the same network and stuff, but you're an incredibly busy man, and when you're talking, I just think, oh, I wonder what he thinks about this. I wonder what he thinks about this. I wonder what he thinks about this. And I just find myself just wanting to leapfrog all over the place and just to hear what you have to say.
Right. So, yeah, definitely.
It's your program. Leap away.
Well, but at the same time, I love what you're talking about too, but I'm thinking about things like anti-gravity, about free energy, about, the physics of spiritual body. And, as we're talking, I'm thinking of the Children of Woolpit, the story from, England, of those green children that came out of what appeared to be some tunnel. And they talked about their land being, subterranean and green, and, there was no sunlight. It was green, and they had green skin. And, I have all these things jumping through my mind when we're talking about Hollow Earth. But I do want to ask you, because this is something I'm curious about. When we're talking about the idea of the Earth being a crust with a mantle and then some kind of space or void and then a core, does the dynamic of gravity change when you move closer to that dense core? I don't understand gravity well enough to know, but as you go inward, does the power of gravity change, or is it consistent throughout?
We believe that gravity does change. If you read Newton's musings about gravity inside of spheres, he has what he calls a section called thin shell physics. And in thin shell physics, it's of course largely theoretical and mathematical. And what he basically says is, once you're inside the sphere, all the gravity cancels itself out and you're weightless. And theoretically, that is correct. But then he has a section that he calls thick shell physics, which is, if you just look at the math formulas, it's an extrapolation of multiple thin shell physics. So the answer is, we don't really know for sure, because we've never sent a probe inside the planet, so we have not measured it to be sure. But what we can do is a thought experiment. So if, for instance, I were to take everybody listening tonight, all million of us, and put us into an elevator at the surface, and then we're going to take the elevator to the core, and we're going to be standing on a bathroom scale in the elevator. So as the elevator goes down, deeper and deeper, 1 mile, 100 miles, 500 miles, 2,000 miles, what do you think the weight, our weight, is doing on the vacuum scale?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm thinking that the way the scale measures weight might change because the density of it would change if gravity's different. Is that right or no?
No, let's just assume, let's cancel all that out.
Okay.
Let's just say what we're talking about is our, you and I, we are currently accelerating toward the center of the Earth at 32 feet per second per second. Fortunately, we're standing on the ground, so our acceleration is arrested by the ground. But we're still accelerating toward the center of the Earth at 32 feet per second per second, and that's why I weigh 0.1 metric tons on the scale when I'm here on the surface.
Okay.
But the truth is, as we get closer and closer to the core, the very mass that's creating that acceleration is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. In fact, at a certain point, you can say there's more mass above my head than there is below my feet.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So there is a point at which, and this is actually measurable, because we've measured gravity on the top of mountains and we've measured gravity in the bottom of the valleys, and we find that there is a difference.
That's right.
In fact, theoretically, your head weighs less than your feet.
That's right.
Just in that short, theoretically, it's probably not measurable because we don't have that resolution, but we can tell, say, from the top of Everest to the bottom of, say, Holland, or some of the low places in the Earth that are below sea level, we can tell the difference. It's measurable.
Okay.
So if it's measurable in 8,444 meters, which is the height of Mount Everest, then it should be measurable in 8,444 miles, which that puts you on the other side of the planet, but somewhere in the middle, you would reach zero gravity.
Oh, okay.
So if that's the case, then that means that the crust that is now above your head, because let's say you're 2,000 miles into the planet,
right,
the crust is actually attracting mass upward.
Ah, so it is pulling upward.
Yes. But you could actually stand on the inside of the crust, the same as you can stand in China on the other side of the planet, and still have my feet are facing the feet of people in Beijing right now.
And that is exactly where we were going with that, because now that speaks to something possibly living not on top of the core, like you would think, but actually on the bottom side of the crust or the mantle. And that brings to question the sun in the center of the Earth. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, but let me add a little bit more credulity to the possibility.
Okay.
Because there was an experiment done. Now, it was with data that was already collected. It was collected for a long time without this idea in mind. But the data was later treated by graduate students at Washington University under the direction of Dr. Y. Sessions. I brought this up in the last time I was on your program.
Mm-hmm.
They took 600,000 printouts, the seismograms themselves, and they analyzed the wave shapes of those seismograms, the vibrations that are picked up by these seismometers, which, you know, most of the vibrations, the big vibrations, do come from earthquakes, sometimes more than, you know, 1,200 earthquakes in a day. They're small, one or less on the Richter scale. But there are other vibrations that are picked up. And it's these other vibrations that really made a breakthrough in the idea that planets might form as hollow spheres. Because what they picked up in the vibrations were actually damping waves of water crashing against a shoreline underneath the crest.
Right.
Wow.
In fact, this ocean that they measured was larger, or about the same size, as the Atlantic Ocean, and it was underneath the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, wow.
So if you have waves crashing, that means that you have airspace above the water, for one thing.
It has to.
You also have gravity you also have gravity holding that water against the bottom of the crust.
Huh.
Now,
that's incredible.
I'm not a paleobiologist.
That's incredible.
But I will tell you, without any doubt in my mind, that if there's water there and there's airspace there,
there's life.
Liquid water, I guarantee you there will be life.
Sure. Now, is there a possibility that those bodies of water could somehow be connected from the surface to the under surface?
Well, that's what we wanted to do with the North Pole in Earth expedition. What we wanted to do was rent the icebreaker for 15 days, uh-huh. and we wanted to go searching for that vent. We were running on the assumption that there's no big, like, you know, 150-mile wide or 400-mile wide whirlpool that is in the ocean that leads down into the center of the Earth. We were saying, okay, let's say that doesn't exist.
Right.
Because I think that would have been spotted by now. Let's just say 4,400 meters deep, there's a huge fissure in the ground, and the two oceans are mixing at this point. Now, hear me out. Because in 2007, there was a really anomalous temperature and wind condition in the Arctic. It was warmer than usual. It was windier, longer than usual. And what happened was the polar ice cap calved. That is to say, it broke off a state-sized piece of ice.
Oh, sure.
And the Northwest Passage became navigable for the first time in, well, I don't know, maybe 100,000 years. I don't know, a long time. The interesting thing is that in the year 2008 and 2009, they were doing marine sampling off the coast of Malaysia. They do this ever so often, and they sample specific species of rays, like manta rays and stingrays, rays. Because rays, as it turns out in the ocean, are very sensitive to ecological changes, chemistry, temperature, CO2 levels in the water. They're sensitive to it. And so they sample those life forms and, you know, do measurements on them. Normally, they find between 20 and maybe on a high end 50 new species of rays because they mutate rather quickly.
Right.
In 2008 and 2009, they found 1,500 new species of rays.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Now, when you couple this with the fact that the Northwest Passage became navigable, that somehow this fissure might have become exposed to our ocean, it's possible that the two ecosystems mixed.
Right.
And some of the species that only exist in that realm were drawn up through that fissure and made their way to warmer waters.
Oh.
I say that because there were things about these rays and other species of squid and things like this and sharks that we thought were extinct for millions of years.
Right.
We found fossils. We found fossils, but these were not fossils. These were fully developed adults. These were healthy swimming animals that we have not seen in nets ever. We found, as I said, fossils, but nothing alive. Things like a dorsal fin squid, what's called a frilled shark. It has no eyes. It's made to swim in waters that don't have sunlight. It navigates other ways.
Wow.
And all these species sprang up in like this period right after the Northwest Passage opened up. That's why we wanted to go up there and find this fissure, because we thought if we could take water samples as close as we could get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be able to prove that the water chemistry was different, the crystallinity of the water, that is to say, when it freezes, the salinity, acidity of the water, and maybe even microbial life, plankton and other things that would exist inside the Earth, probably wouldn't survive on the surface of the Earth because of the exposure to sunlight, but because it's a different wavelength altogether. We're talking, you know, from about 300 nanometers all the way to about 1,100 nanometers from the sun, but you're not going to get that broad range of frequencies from an iron crystal.
Right. Wow. So do you believe then that the iron crystal actually is potentially illuminating this interior if it's there?
Oh, there's no doubt. At 6,000 degrees C, iron will put out a white light that is suitable for photosynthesis.
Yep, there you go.
That's outstanding. You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen.
That's awesome.
That is so cool. And this is why we say it's the science of the paranormal, because, of course, the idea of a hollow earth is you know, in mainstream science, anything that doesn't follow the propaganda that is accepted, then it becomes a joke. It becomes a mockery. But when you're hearing things like this, it suddenly creates a whole new level of plausibility to these beliefs and these accounts that people claim to have. And I think that's incredibly, incredibly profound.
You know, and what's nice about it is this is science that's talking and extrapolation from that science.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you want to be hard-headed about, you know, you know, there's no such thing as evolution and science is a joke and it's all, you know, religion, or if you're on the other side of that, you know, I mean, if you're all science, then there is no doubt that you have to believe this. This is my opinion.
Wait a minute. I am hard-nosed. I don't believe in evolution. I don't think there's such a thing as a theory of evolution, because, as I said, theories require facts.
Right.
Uh-huh. And they don't have any facts to back up evolution.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, that's good to hear, because, you know, again, that's another thing that's just jammed down our throats and we're just supposed to accept it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What is the game plan with that anyway, Brooks? You know, being a scientific insider, what is the game plan to them, you know, jamming these rationales down people's throats and, you know, mocking anything that disagrees with it? What are they going for?
Well, one might think that this is a battle of ideas and that some idea is going to win. Let me lay that theory to rest right now.
Okay.
That is not the plan at all.
Mm-hmm.
The plan is to keep the system in a state of confusion. If I were, let's say I were a Nephilim, I was tasked with watching over mankind, and I screwed up and, well, screwed the pooch, so to speak, and I lost my authority to do what I was supposed to do, but now I'm cursed for being here. So I cursed to being here. What I would do is I would form as many religions as I possibly could, and then I would immediately assign all these religions to hating all other religions.
Mm.
It would be beautiful. It would be a magnificent maelstrom of chaos. And then, just to make things interesting, I would throw in the theory of evolution just to make the scientists believe that all the religions are wrong.
Reminds me of that Far Side comic where God's making the earth and he said, this ought to make it interesting. He's got a shaker full of jerks. He's tapping it out over the bowl.
Oh,
that's about right. So that's about it. I mean, there is no theory of evolution. There's a hypothesis of evolution.
Okay.
But for all the experiments that we have done, and believe me, there have been millions of them done, fruit flies, bacteria, horses, dogs, everything you could think of, and not one single solitary example of one species jumping to another.
Wow.
There are no missing links, no fossils of missing links, no DNA of missing links. It doesn't exist.
Wow. So let's take this hollow earth.
There's that thing.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say there's adaptation within a species.
Okay.
Because genes are remarkable proteins. They actually have a range of proteins that they can replicate. And depending on stresses that are put on the environment, and they could be all kinds of things, from temperature, exposure to sunlight, diet, predators, infections, all kinds of stuff, genes will make a variety of proteins, but they don't jump species. That doesn't happen.
Wow. Okay. So Wow. I mean, that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother journey altogether. You know, you have to come back more and more. It's just spider webs every time. It's like, oh, I want to ask him this, but I want to ask him this, but I want to know what he's going to say about that. I keep doing this in my head, but I was going to say back to the Hollow Earth idea. Then have you heard the story of the children of Woolpit?
I heard various stories, and I, as a scientist, you know, we're not supposed to throw out any data. Although I must confess, there are people, even in my science, that do it all the time. They throw out data that doesn't agree with their hypothesis, and that's just wrong. Because you can fool people for a long time doing that, but eventually, somebody's going to say, "What about this?" For instance, his name escapes me right now, but he's the author of a book called Biological Predestination. Mm-hmm. It was a textbook in molecular biology, and believe it or not, it was a bestseller, which is really odd for a deep textbook.
Wow.
And it was because of this popularity and because of his incredible leadership in this science that he attracted very, very brilliant students. And one of the students one day asked him a question that he could not answer, not for a little while. They said, look, we understand the complexity of these macromolecules unfolding and then refolding back up, you know, duplicating themselves through the chromosomal activities of nuclei of various cells. But where did the first protein come from?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that he could not answer. So about the end of the semester, he came back and he said, look, I want to answer your question about where did the first protein come from? Where did the first DNA molecule come from? And he said, plain and simple, it's an engineered molecule.
Oh, wow. Oh, no.
Okay.
Wow.
So now we're talking about intelligent design. We're talking about intelligent energy and intention put into the building of a molecular system. And make no mistake, DNA, it's a brilliant, you know, helical molecule, but it is a system in and of itself. It isn't alive, but it has a program written into it with amino acids. And each genetic makeup has within the limits of that program certain things it can do, which is remarkable and very broad, very adaptable, and certain limits to what it cannot do. And that's why, you know, we have species go extinct all the time, because they cannot any longer adapt to the environment. They've run out of choices in their proteins, and they can no longer survive.
Okay. So it's just a matter of a certain, it can sustain certain stressors for a certain period of time or a certain introduction of stressors up to a point, but at some point it's just going to collapse.
It either adapts or collapses.
And there's, I would add something to that, because it has something, well, it has a lot to do with the level of consciousness of the being that's occupying that biological transducer. I say that with confidence because, you know, when you're talking about one-celled animals being able to add, you know, highly complex machines like a flagellum or an eye or something like that and be able to, you know, vastly improve their survivability, that doesn't happen through mutation. That happens with intelligent design. But humans are a little bit different. We have the ability to behold, and that's a very powerful word of observation these days. Mm-hmm. We have the ability to behold our environment, not just the environment we're sitting in, but the past environment and the future environment. Uh-huh. And when we apply our attention to those things, we are, by definition, putting energy into those realms. And that will change those realms. Like the movie Next, when Nicolas Cage in the very beginning of the movie is narrating it.
Yeah.
He said the future changes because you looked at it. Mm-hmm. Oh. That is true. So humans are much better and much more powerful at changing and altering our own choices that our genes can make. We've seen it too many times in medical history and recent medical history. People that you know, pray tumors away. They don't take any drugs. It's just the intention of someone else applied to that biochemical structure changes that biochemical structure, and the cancer ceases to live. It dies. It goes away.
Wow. That is absolutely amazing. And it's again, you know, the whole idea that by observing, we change the matter. But what you're saying, we actually change the future. And what about the past then? Is that also changeable?
Within a range, yes. Okay. In my book, Remembering the Future, I assert that time is not a straight line behind us. It's more like a drinking straw or a funnel, the small end of a funnel. There are ranges of changes that we can make to our past. Yes, you can go back and you can change the past. Now, you can't replace that finger that you cut off when you were 17 years old, or you know, the eye you poked out, or thumb you lost on the wringer washer when you were 5 years old. But you can change how you react to it, and that can change everything.
That's profound. We're going to go to our hour break, ladies and gentlemen. Again, our guest tonight is Mr. Brooks Agnew, and it's nothing short of amazing, but we'll continue the discussion on the other side of the break, so don't go away. It's only going to get better, ladies and gentlemen.
If you like this episode of Paranormal Portal and you want to catch part two, we'll post that up next week. And thank you for listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcast Network.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Barton, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.